Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Me, I'm super fly, super duper fly. Remember the music of the 1990s? Rob Harvilla certainly does. Rob has been a professional rock critic for more than 20 years. He's the host of the Ringer podcast and the now companion book called 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. Rob says that his book contains shrewd musical analysis, vital cultural and historical context, and whimsical personal digressions. I gotta say that Rob's whimsical personal digressions are among the many highlights of his book. But I digress. Rob serves up a smorgasbord of scintillating songs from a wide selection of genres, including grunge, hip-hop, R&B, and ska. Just like in his podcast, Rob shows how a single song could capture so much about the 90s era, whether it was Salt-N-Pepa's takes on sex, Green Day's Selling Out, or the grunge counter-programming of the Counting Crows. As a music-obsessed teenager during the 90s, Rob says that this project is also very personal.
I think I've been obsessed with music all my life. It's the way I, you know, understand the world and move through the world. And I think that's been true since I was like 4 years old, you know, with my parents' albums, you know, record collection, vinyl. But in the 90s, it's doubly true because I was a teenager, man. I was in high school. I was in college. All I wanted to do was grow up and write for Rolling Stone. All I did was sit in my bedroom and listen to my CDs, you know, in terms of explaining the 90s in any sense, the only way I can even begin to do that or pretend to do that is through the songs that I listen to, you know, 400,000 times a piece.
Yeah. Chuck Klosterman, who gave you that nice blurb on the front cover of your book, he wrote a whole book on the 90s, and he described the one characteristic of the decade as the desire not to sell out. You have a whole chapter on bands facing this dilemma. Which song or band do you think best represents this struggle?
Probably if you're going one song, one band, that's got to be Green Day, who grew up in the Bay Area, you know, as part of this fiercely independent Bay Area punk scene, you know, 924 Gilman, you know, this mythic venue that it is understood you cannot play Gilman if you're a major label. And they signed to a major label and they are like excommunicated from Gilman. You know, they really anger people and people write all kinds of angry letters to the editor, angry reviews, like magazines, Maximum Rock and Roll, who had loved them previously, just totally turn on them. And it hurts them. Green Day sells whatever Dookie sold, like 10 million, I think maybe even closer to 20 million now records, copies. But they're heartbroken at having lost the community that they started out in, that they grew up in.
Sometimes I give myself the creeps. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm cracking up. Am I just paranoid? Am I just stuck?
And I think that's the starkest example, you know, of people being so upset with the band for the crime of signing, you know, to a label that can better distribute their music. Like, I understand, you know, the dilemma there, and I understand the arguments, you know, of the purity of an independent label, but it is an idea that just does not make any sense. The reason it is such a 90s concept is that it basically did not survive the 90s, this idea of selling out. You know, it's just not a thing people agonize about at all anymore.
Yeah, very well said. Selling out seems quaint nowadays, but even in the 90s, it was a little bit different for hip-hop acts. How so?
You know, I've been doing the show for 3 years. You know, each episode is one song. And so when it comes time to write a book, like I have to radically distill, you know, 600,000 words of raw material, you know, into a coherent book. And so when I think about doing a sellout chapter, I'm trying to think about different ways to define that term. And in the case of Coolio, say, or Ice Cube, the agony that they're, it's not agony, but the struggle they're having is that suddenly they're huge in the suburbs. You know, suddenly they have this huge white audience, you know, that has no experience with South Central LA, you know. And I think it was Ice Cube who said, like white kids are eavesdropping on my music. Like, it's fine if they listen to it. I'm glad they enjoy it. I'm certainly glad they buy it. But like, I'm making music for black people and white people are eavesdropping on me. And I think Coolio is the same way. Like, Coolio came up in a far more independent scene in Los Angeles, but suddenly he's a household name, right? Suddenly the Fantastic Voyage is everywhere and everybody knows the Braids, you know, and Weird Al, you know, is doing a parody of him that caused a whole kerfuffle. He's agonizing over the fact that, like, this isn't the audience that I sought. And he's honestly very concerned that, like, he's being viewed as a caricature, you know, and he has to sort of push against that. It just fascinated me the different ways that you could take that idea of selling out.
Erykah Badu gets your vote for the best live performer of her generation. Why?
When I did an episode on her, that's the song I did an episode on. It's a song called Tyrone. I think it was very new when she did it. Like, she put out her debut album in 1997, and then she did a live album like almost immediately afterward. And this was like, she was introducing this song to the audience, you know, and it's like a breakup song. It's like a diss song, you know, against the person who she's just broken up with. And all the women in the audience are screaming the entire time. Like, they're so delighted and they relate to this song so thoroughly, so immediately. It's just an incredible interaction between Erykah and the crowd, just this audible sense that they're connecting, you know, on such a visceral level. It's just, it's delightful. It's got to be Tyrone, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Erykah was just one of several women making a big splash in the 1990s. And you make a distinction between women in rock and women of rock. What is the difference?
I think what that was like, you would see women in rock, yeah, well, issues of Rolling Stone or like VH1 packages, whatever, whatever. And they kept switching between women in rock and women of rock. And I was trying to answer that question myself. Like, in feels a little deeper into rock than of rock. You know what I'm saying? We're getting into the linguistic weeds here, I guess. But yeah, it's like to some degree they're interchangeable, but I do think there is a subtle difference that I'm still parsing. Like, what does it mean to be a woman of rock? It means that you came from rock versus, you know, you're a woman and you are, this is an incursion into rock by women, right? It's whether you're coming from the inside or whether you're coming in from the outside. There you go.
Yeah, that works for me. Well done. Very well done.
That was very stressful. Yeah, yeah. All right.
Woo. Yeah. You covered so many of these artists like Dolores O'Riordan, PJ Harvey, and Tori Amos. And I really love your take on the Breeders' 1993 hit Cannonball. Can you share your take on that?
My take is that I love that song. The killer bass line, courtesy of bassist Josephine Wiggs. The Deal Sisters' audible switchblade smiles as they harmonize on the line, spitting in a wishing well. The split second of dead air right after the Deals harmonize extra sweetly on the line, the bong in this reggae song. The giddy insubordination of that silence, which packs more personality than any other band's noise.
Reggae song.
You know, I'm from Ohio, right? I'm from the Cleveland area. I live in Columbus now. The Breeders are from Dayton. You know, that makes a huge difference if you're in Ohio, and maybe not as big a difference if you're not. But it's Kim Deal's voice, the front person of the Breeders. Kim Deal's voice is just the greatest musical instrument ever invented, in my opinion. There's just this quality that it has that's so playful and so sinister at the same time, you know, like a children's librarian, like reading you the scariest story you've ever heard in your entire life. And, you know, Cannonball was just such a blast of fresh air on the radio in 1993. You know, you're at the height of grunge. you're at the height of, you know, the Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Nexus. And I worshipped those bands, and I worship them at great length in this book and on this show. But Cannonball, you know, was just such a noisy, chaotic, you know, like the first 60 seconds is all like sound effects, and like the song takes forever to get going in a way that's so appealing to me. It just struck me as revolutionary at the time. I'm 15 or whatever, and I cannot believe that these people live in the same state that I live. I can't believe they live on the same planet as I do.
You share many hilarious personal anecdotes in the book. My favorites are from your chapter on songs dealing with sex. It seems that every generation had those uncomfortable and misinterpreted moments with pop songs. What song do you think best captures the vibe of the 90s?
One of the songs I talk about is Shoop.
Hey, yeah, I wanna shoot, baby, shoot.
Salt and Pepper. I loved Salt and Pepper, you know, from Push It Forward. Push It was late 80s, but Salt and Pepper in the early 90s, throughout the 90s, you know, they were so frank about sexuality, but in a weirdly kind of wholesome way, right? Like the song Let's Talk About Sex is partially, you know, sexy, but it's partially like a very honest discussion, you know, about gender dynamics and about love versus lust, and, you know, and it spoke to teenagers. You know, you think about the classic adults talking to teenagers where they like turn the folding chair around and like they sit really cool, you know, and like they try and connect with teenagers on their level. I feel like Let's Talk About Sex and the larger, you know, Salt and Pepper catalog, this applies to Shoop. You know, this applies to Push It. You know, this applies to Do You Want Me? Everything they did, there's something simultaneously so playful and flirty, but also like very serious, very honest, very earnest about the way that they talk about these things.
You're packed in your stack, especially in the back. Brother, I want to thank your mother for a butt like that. Can I get some fries with that shake, shake, booby? If looks could kill, you would be an Uzi or a shotgun. Bang! What's up with that? I want to know.
It's almost weirdly moving to me, you know, now that my kids are approaching teenagers, you know, and they're going on YouTube and just looking up stuff I can't even fathom, you know, I'm on the other end of this now. I remember growing up driving around with my mom, listening to pop radio, you know, and Belle Biv DeVoe's Do Me would come on and it would just be moaning noises for 30 seconds. She would just slam the car radio off, right? And I was like, oh, mom. And like, but now I understand. You know, to be a parent and to have pop music, to have, you know, internet culture, whatever, talking to my kids about sex, you know, whether I know it or not, whether I like it or not. But there's just something about those songs simultaneously like expresses lust, but in just such a smart, such a careful way that never sounds didactic. It never sounds like a lecture. You know, there's something so earnest and so singular about their approach that I really admire.
Very well said. I was delighted that you included the Counting Crows hit, Mr. Jones, produced by T-Bone Burnett. I really love that song, the lyrics, and I think Adam Duritz's lead vocals are fantastic. What do you think of Mr. Jones?
It's funny with the Counting Crows because I really liked Mr. Jones on the radio, and of course I listened to it hundreds of thousands of times, and his vocal delivery, and I can still see him in the video like bouncing with that jacket, you know, it's so dorky. I always thought of that as like grunge counter programming, right? You know, like I was growing up on Alice in Chains, you know, the hard gritty stuff, you know, where everyone was so dour, and then here comes, you know, Counting Crows, Hootie and the Blowfish, whatever, and it's nominally more cheerful, you know, more agreeable, more copacetic, but there's a darkness to the Counting Crows. And Mr. Jones is a song, you know, about wanting to be famous, you know, but knowing that that's not going to solve any of your problems. And then for some reason, that record, right, August and Everything After, like I liked the hit songs, but I didn't own that CD. The first Counting Crows CD I listened to in full was the next one, Recovering the Satellites. And I fell so hard for that record. And it's a record about reckoning with being famous. But, you know, I talked a lot about the song A Long December.
And it's one more day up in the canyon. And it's one more night in Hollywood. And it's so long since I've seen the ocean. I guess I should.
I love that song so much, and that song clearly means so much to so many people. And then I read interviews with Adam Duritz, like interviews now, you know, podcast things he does. And he's like, yeah, you know, I forget what he says and I don't want to paraphrase it, but he's like, songs used to be the only thing that mattered to me. And I thought that, you know, my personal life might be in shambles, but look at all these songs I wrote. And now that I'm older, I realize that like songs are a poor substitute for like actual personal relationships, for life, you know. And it's just, it's the way of saying that, you know, it's the people who matter, you know, not the things you do, the things you write, the art you create. Even if that art turns out to be adored by millions of people, you know, it still doesn't feel as hollow, you know, as just having your stuff together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rob Harvilla, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on 60 songs that explain the 90s, the book, and the podcast. It was such a pleasure to talk to you and to read your book.
Hey, man, thanks so much for having me on. That's very kind of you to say. I'm honored. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Rob Harvilla is the author of 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. Find out more about Rob, his podcast, and the 90s at WPR.org/beta. And while you're at it, let us know what your favorite 90s songs are and why you love them. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Jeff Daniels, Matt Singer, and Rob Harvilla.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
The two gents helping me put the show together each week are Steve Gotcher and Adam Friedrich.
We have no talents and we don't really fit into society.
Maybe we'll be film critics.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Just when I think you couldn't possibly be any dumber, you go and do something like this.
And totally redeem yourself!